very, very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to be pleased. Like, when Positive Money started 3 years ago, like, no one believed us that I mean, I wasn't working there then, but Ben, who set it up, nobody believed him that that's how money was created. Even people that worked at the Bank of England didn't realise. So to be at a stage where they actually, you know, an institution of authority is saying that is how money's created, that's really great. There's still a lot of things that they haven't said, but it allows us to move on. So we can now, you know, when people say that I don't believe you, we can say, well, the Bank of England says it works this way as well, and kind of move on to implications that has, like the problems, and then how we need to discuss different ways of the money system working. So it's really exciting. It moves us forward quite a big step.
Why did they come out and make this announcement, Fran?
Well, I think part of it is, so they have a quarterly release where they release some articles which are kind of researchy, I guess. And the book that we wrote with, called Where Does Money Come From?
Yes.
That's been read quite a lot by people that work in the Bank of England. And the organisation we wrote it with, the New Economics Foundation, have kind of told them that they need to do some educational materials around it. So I think it's definitely partly due to pressure from us and the New Economics Foundation, for sure. And also the fact that more and more economists and people that work in Bank of England are realising they don't really understand how money works. So it's quite good.
Have you had any opportunity to speak out, to give speeches about it?
I mean, we're invited to lots of kind of students or universities, and we speak with, like, we've had meetings with kind of high level people, but we haven't been able to get any kind of big coverage on it because I think the media are just afraid of it as a subject. It's too abstract, and, you know, but we're trying.
Yeah, if you speak up even at student meetings and to explain the implications of a shortage of money, then other people will ask you to speak there too.
Yeah. So shall I tell you a bit about the Positive Money Conference? Or?
Yes, please.
Please.
So yeah, that went really well. It was on the 1st of March, and we had 250 people. And about 35 of those people were from different countries. So we had quite a few people from Denmark, someone from Iceland, Sweden, France, Germany, Portugal, someone from Spain, somebody from California came over, someone from Luxembourg and Belgium, and somebody that lives in China came. So that was really exciting, and I think the Scandinavian countries like Iceland, Denmark and Sweden are all quite excited because they all have their own currencies and they feel like they can get bigger campaigns off the ground. And for example, in Iceland, the guy that's running the campaign, he's friends with the finance minister who really wants money reform to happen. So, so there's definitely progress in these smaller countries in Scandinavia, and the Eurozone countries the campaign groups are talking to each other. So that's great. And then the other part of the conference was groups from all over the UK setting up reading groups, so in kind of different geographical locations. So there are groups now, you know, in the northwest of England, in the northeast, in the southwest. There's lots of groups in London, there's some in Scotland and Wales.
That's great.
Yeah, if they break through, that'll help us. Other place, right over.
Okay.
How, Alfred, in the meeting that you had on March 1st, did you have any economists speaking? Who was speaking?
Well, this year we, because there are so many other events that economists speak at, and we decided that if we're getting people together, it should really be about them kind of forming groups and relationships so they'll go and organise afterwards. Because if we've had economists speak in the past, and it just feels like to me that you can kind of reach a lot of people by having online talks now. So if an economist does a talk and it gets recorded, it can reach like hundreds of thousands of people. So we deliberately only had myself and Ben gave a talk.
Oh.
And then we had some of the supporters give little talks. We had some district councillors come down from the middle of the UK because they'd... So we had like some examples of positive money stuff being used in different contexts. We had some people from a district council. We had one of the local groups speak. And who was the other one? There was another one. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, so it was really good.
Are we going to get to see any videos of this?
Yeah. Starting from this week, there should be videos of all the talks online.
Oh, okay, cool.
That sounds really good. I mean, you know, to get the people on the ground talking to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, it was good. A lot of energy.
Good.
Hey, Fran, it's Martin here. Is there a place online that you can find where the Bank of England has formally stated that this is how they do create money?
I'll send you the links around now, but it's the quarterly bulletin.
Uh-huh.
So if you kind of Googled Bank of England quarterly bulletin, like March 2014, it would probably come up. If I just email it around now, then you've got it.
Okay.
I think you should use the phrase how banks conjure up money, not how they create it.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a quote from Nick Egnatz in Chicago at the meeting.
Good.
Great. Okay, so I'm going to get started with the class because, boy, there's a lot of information. It's only half the chapter.
Yeah.
It's and it's also important. This, you know, this Bank of
England. Well, that's Patterson right there.
Yep.
Right. So this is part one of chapter 11, and Stephen named it "Hatching the Bank of England like a little chick."
It was in an egg.
Carried the egg across the channel.
What did people think of this half of the chapter, or maybe you read the whole chapter?
I read it 2 weeks ago, and I don't remember what I read.
Well, it's kind of material that's a little overwhelming.
Yes.
You know, to put it in the whole context of our... Because I started making connections with this chapter of today's world.
Montague. I have a question. Norman Montague... was a good friend of Benjamin Strong in the Depression, in the 20s, I should say. Is he descended from that Charles Montague there, first Earl of Halifax?
That's a good question. Fran, any idea?
Sorry, what was that? Who he is?
The Norman Montague conspired with Benjamin Strong in the 20s to inflate the money in the United States so something, the gold would shift towards England. For some reason, I can't remember. I think the reason was they wanted France to withdraw their gold out of England.
Okay.
Was he related to Charles Montague in this pic photograph here?
Good question.
Yeah, don't know. Maybe we should look it up.
Yeah, that's very good. We'll do that. That's very good.
The sons of the father.
Well, yeah. Well, Stephen makes a point. It's at the very end of this PowerPoint. about, you know, how much of the control, how much it was spread around, you know. So
kind
this
of trivia that I remember.
Oh no, that's very important, making that connection, I think. Yeah. So this is the Bank of England, and these are the people that Stephen names. Charles Montague, first Earl of Halifax, and Stephen gets him the most prominence in terms of getting this proposal through Parliament and the Crown. Okay. And Sir William Paterson, and I think it's P-A-T-E-R-S. I think I spelled it wrong. I see that right there.
Yeah, it's the Latin father.
Right. He's the one that whose name is always associated with the creation of the bank, although he left the bank after around a year, dissatisfied with the way it was being run. And Michael Godfrey, I couldn't find a picture of him. He was a merchant in the hat, and he pushed this plan through with the merchants in the City of London. Because the City of London was where the financial transactions occurred at this point in English history. Okay, so, did anybody else besides Anne, have a comment about the chapter?
I found it interesting to read the opposition to the founding of the Bank of England. It was good to know that there was opposition there, however misguided at the time.
Right, right. Yeah, some of the details, right, of the fighting going on. Okay, so, hello.
I don't think I read it.
Okay.
I just read it.
Oh, what's happening to my control here?
I don't know. Let's see if we got any control.
I'm going to try it again.
Control.
Let me see if I can try it again. Okay, now I got it. Here's our famous themes. The primary importance of the money power. Stephen's very good at implementing these. The nature of money purposely kept secret and confused. How a society defines money determines who controls the society. And the battle over the control of money, and it is indeed a battle, has raged for millennia, public versus private. And our edition by Will and Martin, the misuse of the monetary system causes tremendous misery and suffering for the ordinary working people.
Yeah.
But we're not getting.
There's going to be 9 parts to this half of the chapter. William III and the control of money. We'll talk a little about him and Parliament. The science of money is recovered, but privately. The real need for a bank. The numerous proposals for a bank, of which there were many. There's a lot going on around that time, with ideas from all sides. Paterson's proposal, Montague's bank. So we'll get in that. In there, we'll go into the details of the bill. The Bank of England founded in stealth, and we'll talk about that because it's, well, Fran announced that the Bank of England has just admitted that their member banks create the money. So, the opposition to the bank, we'll talk a little bit about that. First failure of the bank, which is it a failure or was it planned? We'll look at that. And the gradual development of the bank, which Stephen makes the point which I think is a good point, so I put that in there. Okay. Will and Fran, do you have the PowerPoint?
Yep.
Okay. So, William III and the control of money. So, Fran, why don't you do the first slide there?
Oh, hang on, I have William III and the control of money.
Yes.
This is the English Bill of Rights. William could not cancel the charter of the bank and issue his own paper money because of the 1689 English Bill of Rights, which describes the limits on the powers of the Crown.
Excuse me, Fran. What was going on at that time? How did that come about, the Bill of Rights, if I may ask?
I have no idea. I don't know English history at all.
I have no idea. I'm English.
Let me add something to it. 1688 was the revolution when William came over with his Dutch fleet and invaded England and was accepted by these Whigs who had invited him over. So they had him there, and he was a new monarch, right? So they were going to, like our Bill of Rights, say, okay, this is the power of Parliament, and he had to agree to this in order to be coronated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead, Fran.
Power of Parliament to do the right.
Okay, so... which sets up powers of the Crown and sets out the rights of Parliament. That the pretended power of suspending the laws or the execution of laws by regal authority without consent of Parliament is legal.
Illegal.
That the
Did you say legal or illegal?
Illegal. That the pretended power of dispensing with laws or the execution of laws by regal authority, as it hath been assumed and exercised of late, is illegal. That levying of money for or to the use of the Crown by pretence of prerogative without grant of Parliament for longer time or in other manner than the same is or shall be granted is illegal. And there's a picture of King William addressing the convention Parliament in 1689.
Right, so they were making sure his hands as a crowned leader were tied. You see that?
Yeah.
They weren't going to invite him back and then let him do what he wanted.
Yeah. So what was he allowed to do?
Well, wage war.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Everybody needs somebody to do that.
The next one, Will, do the next one.
Okay, just a second. Let me see where I'm at. Number six, wait a minute.
No.
I gotta go down. Just a second. Is that it, the one with purple? Yeah, William III, and the control of money. English Bill of Rights, Declaration of Rights is another name for it. This bill was passed to protect the liberties of Englishmen against its tyrants as James II. At the coronation, William and Mary heard the Declaration of Rights read to them, and they were asked to accept the crown. William replied, "We thankfully accept what you have offered us and promised to rule according to law and be guided by Parliament." As if the maddest of believers in the divine right of kings had ever fashioned in imagination a tyranny 100th part as strong as that which was clamped upon us by the Revolution of 1688. And that was said by Christopher Hollis in The Two Nations on page 34.
And what Christopher Hollis was referring to was the Dutch William came over bringing the financial machinations and ended up eventually with the control of the country by the Bank of England. So,
yeah.
On the surface, people will say, oh, the English Bill of Rights, that's to protect the liberties of Englishmen. But it was more to control the king so that the Whig commons and Whig merchants could decide what they were going to do.
Oh, okay.
So we got even something worse. Then
that's a
monarchy.
King. Yeah.
You got a monarchy, tyranny of the banks.
That's right.
Instead of tyranny of the monarch.
That's right.
That's right. Which is worse?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I could be. I guess it could be pretty bad either way.
Well, the tyranny of the monarch, you can see it.
Yeah.
People can see it and do something about it.
Like.
But the tyranny of money, when it's not, it's, you know, nobody knows what's going on.
It's hidden.
Yeah.
Hidden. That's where Hollis was coming from. Yeah.
When did Christopher Hollis say that?
He wrote this book, The Two Nations, in like, I think it was published around 1930.
Oh, okay. So it actually wasn't a contemporary comment.
Yes. Yeah, okay. His book is a financial history of England.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. I highly recommend his book. It's very, very British, very sarcastic like this, you know. A tyranny 100th part is strong. Okay. So, Martin, do the next one. The science of money is recovered, but privately.
Okay.
Do the next two. This is it.
Okay. Hang on a second. Okay. The bank created fiat money, but for private power and profit of a small group. This is usury, a calculated misuse of the money system for private gain. Next one, Bill.
Okay.
Oh, what's the building there that we're looking at?
Let's see.
It's a bakery.
It's a bakery of money.
I heard.
I think that's the old Bank of England building.
That's the next slide.
Here's the books.
Okay. Golly.
The bakery owners obscured the true nature of money.
The bank owners.
While creating abstract money, they put forward a backward commodity concept. Oops, a backward concept of money as gold and silver.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. I think we've lost.
Have we lost time?
Let's see what we've got here.
Forward and backward.
Let's see.
Is that?
Hey, Fran, we've lost you. You want to reconnect? Oh, okay. Okay, maybe. I'll look and see. I've just answered you on...
What?
Yeah, I've answered you on the side phone. I'll see if you're there. I can't see you right now, but if you haven't, we'll just hang up and call again. Bye.
I think that's Stephen. I'm not that sophisticated.
Okay. Well, let's see. Have you got... Can you see Fran?
No.
It's calling her. I can see you, and it's calling her.
Oh, yeah, I get mad. Yeah,
click on the other one.
What other one?
There's two positive monies there. Click on.
Hi, I'm there. I'm back.
Oh, okay. Good.
Okay, great.
Great. Okay. Okay, so the next thing is the real need for a bank. Don, why don't you read this?
The real need for a bank. The money market was chaotic with varying rates of exchange, as it had been in Amsterdam prior to the founding of that bank there. London goldsmith Edward Blackwell, apparently the man in the photograph,
yes,
with the stop of the Exchequer in 1642, a half dozen goldsmith bankers who lent large sums to Charles II were forced to suspend payments. Edward Blackwell was one of these ruined bankers. Many goldsmith bankers, however, were not major lenders to the crown and did carry on. 5 years after the stop of the Exchequer, 44 goldsmith bankers were listed as keeping running cashes. Despite the plague in 1665, the Great Fire the next year in 1666, the stop of the Exchequer in 1672, and a panic in 1682, and the Glorious Revolution of 1688, the system of goldsmith bankers continued functioning through the foundation of the Bank of England in 1694 and the turn of the 18th century.
Right.
The picture is Edward Blackwell, Esquire, Alderman of London in 1679.
Yes. So all this was going on, and the money market was really basically, the banking was in the hands of these private bankers. And it was chaotic with varying rates of exchange, whatever they could get. Okay. Anne, why don't you do this one?
Amsterdam's bank protected her coinage from the clipper, but in England, the illicit activities of the goldsmith bankers continued. The men were hanged with the formalities of the old treason laws. The women were burnt. Oh. You say that's discrimination. But the deterrents were ineffectual, and clipping went on. The fact was that bullion was becoming so much dearer than light coin taken by tail that the temptation to clip, melt, and export was almost irresistible and turned a fashion into a facility. The night smugglers of the South Coast, especially those of Romney Marsh, who were called at that time owlers, were the agents by which the bars were exported and sold. Now we have Thorold Rogers, the first 9 years of the Bank of England. So this Thorold Rogers was a historian.
He was a historian and an economist. He's famous for a book that he did. He traced the prices of commodities in England from the beginning of the Plantagenets in the, like 1500, all the way through to when he was writing, I guess, Thoreau Rogers, sometime in the 1800s, I think. And he showed just seeing the difference in wages versus commodities, meaning this is the wages that working people got. These are the commodities they needed in order to survive. How the government of England was just, on the one hand, saying, the English working man is in the best shape ever before in his history. It was not true. And he did that very successfully. It's a big, fat book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So the words were to hide what was really going on, you know. Yeah.
Keeps on going. Happy to that.
Fran, can you do the next one?
Yeah. So, the real need for a bank. The goldsmiths lent money at exorbitant rates, charging 30 to 80% yearly on small loans. The public had lost millions through the bankruptcies of the goldsmiths and the disappearance of their clerks. The public saw them as more interested in profits than in the safety of their investments. And then we've got a picture of Sir Hugh Middleton, a Welsh goldsmith and engineer in the 1600s, Sir Francis Child, Sir Richard Hall, and Sir Robert Viner. And the caption is, by the restoration of Charles II in 1660, London's goldsmiths had emerged as a network of bankers. The number of goldsmith bankers had estimated it at 32 in 1670, 44 in 1677, 42 in 1700. Some were little more than pawnbrokers, while others were full-service bankers. Goldsmiths offered financial services as fractional reserve, noting note issuing bankers.
Right. Okay. Numerous proposals for a bank. So, here are 38, it's 38 lines, 38 proposals in London to issue paper credit on the basis of the government's taxes, right? So And this is just from 1690 to 1697, the years. So there were a lot of ideas going around. There was a lot of speculation going around in the financial area. A lot of turmoil. And number 13 ended up being the Bank of England, Paterson's proposal. Of all of these, that got through. Okay? And this is just proposals to issue paper notes based on the government's taxes. Okay? And some of these, the design was that there'd be a perpetual debt by the government, and some of them would have a fund that would be structured so that the actual principal of the government debt would eventually be paid off. So there were two ways that they were thinking of it, these proposers, these people. So this is just to say a lot of ideas were whirling around.
What were the ideas of the 13th proposal?
Well, the 13th one was, the author was Paterson, and he called it a brief account of the intended bank. The issuing agency was a private bank, and it was funds for the crown, for the government, not legal tender. The Bank of England notes were not legal tender, not till later in the history of England. Annual revenue pledged was $100,000. That was the interest that the private subscribers to this fund that were going to give their money to the government was £100,000 a year. And it was 8% on £1.2 million. And the term of year was perennial for, you know, they wanted a charter. They got a charter for a certain number of years, and then it got extended. And
they didn't retire in principle?
No. And the capital sum to issue was £1.2 million, and the rate of interest was 8%. Which was on the high side. If you see all the rates of interest here for all these proposals, there was one 9 to 6%, but this one of the higher ones, the 8%. So you can look around and see all of these things happening. Okay. Who spoke last?
Me.
Who? Oh, Anne? Okay. So Fran, do the next one.
Fran spoke last, didn't
you? Oh, Fran spoke last?
Yeah. I think so.
Oh, okay. So Will.
I'll do it, yeah. Numerous proposals for a bank. War was a constant stimulus to these proposals and to the creation of a permanent public debt. Second Anglo-Dutch War from 1665 to 1667. Third Anglo-Dutch War, 1672 to 1674. The Franco-Dutch War, 1672 to 1678. I guess those two were going on pretty much the same time. 9 Years' War, 1688 to 1697, and that was England, Scotland, Germany, Netherlands, Savoy, Spain, and Sweden versus France.
France fought off all of the others?
Yeah. Well, France was big. Willemite War in Ireland, 1688 through 1691. War of the Spanish Succession, 1701 to 1714. That's Great Britain from 1707, Germany, Dutch Republic, Portugal, and Savoy versus France, Spain, and Mantua, and the electorates of Bavaria and Cologne.
Right, because keep in mind, William was Dutch, so he came over to England, but he was also needing to protect Holland, and his need to fight France who was attacking Holland was because that was the country that where he came from. And the English, some of these wars, the English were not as involved in saying, you know, well, it doesn't involve us as much. But of course you have the Anglo-Dutch War, and the two Anglo-Dutch War, which we've talked about the fighting over, you know, the power over that, the trade with the East and the ratio trade and all that, right? So, war. I always keep forgetting that war is the driver, even today, you know, the most profitable is war.
Yeah. So the English and Dutch were fighting.
This is before William came to the throne.
He came. When did he come to the throne?
The Glorious Revolution. What year was that? 1688.
1688. Yeah.
Yeah, that's before.
That
okay, that was before. Okay.
Yeah. I forget what year. What year he became stadtholder in Holland? Meaning one of the rulers sometime now. Martin, next one?
Yep.
Just a sec.
Okay, in the last half of the 17th century, there were 60 proposals, schemes, to increase purchasing power. They were of four kinds. Credit creation based on goods, the pawnbrokers. Credit creation paper bills based on government revenues, Bank of England, etc. Credit creation based on commercial obligations, the commercial banks. And credit creation paper bills based on land banks. Dr. Hugh Chamberlain's proposal to make England rich and happy. The bank was to advance money on the security of landed property by issuing large quantities of notes on the fallacy that a lease of land for a term of years might be worth many times the simple fee.
Yeah, we'll talk about that more later, his plan.
Capitalizing the future rent.
So to have these wars, you needed credit.
Mm-hmm.
And all these proposals were whirling around, I'm sure. A lot of them came from the people that came over from Holland, you know, who are versed in the money system, you know. Patterson's proposal, Montague's Bank. Don, do the next
couple. Great experiment. During the first few years after the revolution in 1694.
No, the revolution of 1688. That he's referring to. William's becoming the monarch of England.
Okay.
Yeah.
Company forming in those few years and stock jobbing were rapidly developed. And just about the time that the bank was founded, the passion for speculation was the Chronicler of Commerce.
Well, that's another sentence. That's another. This is from Thoreau Rogers, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Why don't you do the next one, too?
Charles Montague, one of the founders of the Bank of England, was born with excellent connections, but with insufficient leverage to attain any great position. After Westminster and Trinity College, Cambridge, where he became the lifelong friend of Sir Isaac Newton, he was destined for a career in the church. Politics supervened, however, and in the year after signing the Declaration to the Prince of Orange in 1688.
Let me just interrupt. That means he was one of the people who signed, there were like, I think, seven of them, who signed this document inviting William to come over and accept the crown with his fleet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Montague entered Parliament as member. He soon gained the favor of King William and was appointed a Lord of the Treasury in 1689. In this office, he soon showed a flair for financial planning and for bold strokes of innovation. In December 1689, he devised a scheme, the origin of the national debt, to raise £1 million by taxation of wines and spirits, on the credit of which he sold life annuities which reverted at death to the government.
Does that make sense? How that works?
I can see it. Yeah, but not done completely. Don't know the ramifications.
The annuity, so the annuitant, the one who's buying the annuity, is the subscriber.
He gets
the money to the government.
And he gets an income.
But when he dies,
money goes back to the government.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the government doesn't have to pay him back.
Right.
It's like a reverse mortgage.
So it's not a permanent debt, because all these annuitants will eventually die, and they can't hand it off to their relatives.
That's right.
Right.
Got it.
But it was a way of getting immediate money for the government.
They had to provide one big sum, and then they got interest on it or whatever until they died, and then it went back.
Yes. Yes, that's how it worked. So that was his scheme. So this guy had a lot of...
Innovative.
It was innovative and fashionable from the looks of it.
Yeah.
After the House of Commons, he rose quickly, becoming one of the commissioners of the Treasury and a member of the Privy Council. Mm-hmm. 2 years later, he engineered the tonnage bill, intended to meet the costs of the French War. In order to raise the required £1,200,000, he organized the subscribers into a corporation, known as the Governor and Company, the Governor and Company of the Bank of England. In 1694, he became Chancellor of the Exchequer in reward for having devised the establishment of the Bank of England.
So I think Stephen is saying he's basically the one who pushed it through, who got it through, this guy.
He organized it, figured out how to organize it.
Yeah, he had a lot of clout, and he had understanding. He had understanding of finances.
He had excellent connections, too.
Understanding of the finance.
And in order to found the Bank of England, he didn't have to get a law passed or anything. He just says, well, we need to raise this amount of money, so get some subscribers and we'll call it the Bank of England.
No, it had to go through Parliament.
Oh, it did? Okay.
Oh, yeah. That was the tonnage bill.
Oh, okay.
Became the tonnage act. I guess a bill becomes an act once it's passed. Oh yeah, the power was in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And right.
Chancellor of the Exchequer is Secretary of the Treasury.
Yeah. Anne, why don't you do the next one?
What was Montague's motivation in inviting a Dutch prince to take England's throne, creating the bank that would finance his wars and allow foreign money lenders to dominate England's money system?
That's my question. No one knows the answer. But you wonder, right?
Okay, we see the...
This William III.
That's William. And then this... Is that the... The sealing of the Bank of England charter.
Right, they're signing the charter.
Right.
These are all the governors.
The big wigs, as they say.
The big wigs. Oh, right. I guess that's where it comes from.
Enormous wigs.
A group of women.
They do.
Here,
they do. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
I love it.
Do the next one, Ian.
Michael Godfrey, one of the founders of Bank of England. Young Godfrey and his brother Peter were merchants, and their father predicted that their speculations would speedily bring into hotchpot the whole of their ample fortunes. Godfrey supported William Paterson in the establishment of the Bank of England in 1694. He supported its acceptance among the city merchant. He was rewarded by being elected the first deputy governor of the bank. Soon afterwards, he published an able pamphlet entitled A Short Account of the Bank of England. At a general court held on 16 May 1695...
The general court refers to a meeting of the bank directors. It's not a judicial court. It's a corporate meeting of the bank directors.
Okay. The bank resolved to establish a branch at Antwerp in order to coin money to pay the troops in Flanders. Deputy Governor Sir James Houblon Sir William Scawen and Michael Godfrey were therefore appointed to go thither to methodize the same, His Majesty and the Elector of Bavaria having agreed thereto. On their arrival at Namur, then besieged by William, the king invited them to dinner in his tent. They went out of curiosity into the trenches, where a cannonball from the works of the besieged killed Godfrey as he stood near the king, 17 July 1695. That was the end of Michael Godfrey.
Yeah, that was his death.
Play horse, eat grass.
But notice, it's all related to war. It's all war. Yeah. The money was for war. Mm-hmm. You know?
You forgot that you can get yourself killed out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I read another account of it, and the king was actually turning to him and saying, you know, you shouldn't be here. I need to be here because I'm here to fight, but you don't have to. And he was saying, oh, no, it's okay. And he got killed. You know? I guess that, you know, that they're like people today, they feel like they're, you know, they're invincible. You know, these financiers feel like they're invincible.
Like, I set this whole thing in motion, and therefore I'm in charge of it, and I'm not going to get killed.
Exactly.
I felt that way when I was 23 years old and went into the UDT.
Into the
Frogman training.
The Frogman.
Yeah. I thought Don
went into training to be what is now a Navy SEAL, which is like a trained assassin working for the Navy.
Well, I didn't know I was going to be an assassin.
No, he didn't know. When he found out that, he sort of...
He thought he was just going to be a banker.
No, I wasn't that far off.
Another kind of trained assassin.
Fran, do the next one.
Yeah, I'm here. This is the Buttons proposal, still Montague's bank. The bank hath benefit of the interest on all monies which it creates out of nothing. The Scotsman, William Paterson, a relative of John Law, was born in 1658 to moderately well-off parents. Though brilliant, he received little education. In 1685, in Amsterdam, he became involved in William III's 1688 revolution. Returning to London with William's army, he became rich and influential, organising the North London Water Company with the help of Montague. The plans for the bank were Paterson's, but that Paterson's plan was even adopted can be explained only by its being sponsored by two men of unusual influence and determination. Of course, Charles Montague and Michael Godfrey. Montague put the plan through Parliament, and Godfrey got it past London's merchants.
I wonder what they saw in it then. Wasn't it anything else?
You have to say it to everybody.
I just wonder what they saw in the plan that wasn't bettered by something else with all those proposals coming up.
Well, 8% interest, there was a higher interest rate.
Things have no interest.
He had the right connections to get it through.
That's true.
It's not what you know, it's who you know.
You know, but that's a good question, Don. Mm. What was it about this particular plan that they first picked it, but then they could get it through, too? Montague was able to get it through the Commons, you know, and through the Lords. Will, do the next one.
The proposal. Paterson's proposal, Montague's bank. Number one, £1,200,000 capital raised was to be lent wholly to the government at 8%, the interest to be financed by levying a duty upon the tonnage of ships and vessels, and nearly £100,000. Two, in return for this loan, the bank was to be granted a charter and a right to issue £1,200,000 of banknotes secured only on that loan. The banknotes would circulate as money redeemable in gold. Number three, The banknotes were not legal tender, but were to be acceptable and payable by the crown for all things.
That makes them legal tender.
And there in 1694 banknote of Bank of England that you have, and then you have a picture of some gold coins.
Excuse me, I don't understand how the note was not legal tender, but it was payable by the crown for all things. That's, what's the difference?
That's fiat money.
The legal tender was had to be passed through Parliament. As legal tender. So this is payable by the crown for all things. They could pay it out to buy things. It still wasn't acceptable as for taxes. That came later. That came later.
Okay.
But there were other proposals that were submitted, if you went back and looked at those 38, that wanted what their banknotes to be legal tender. They didn't pass, and a couple of them got shot down in the Commons because they didn't want to give that much power at that point. So, you know, you can see, like what Don said, like, what about this proposal could they get through the Commons, you know?
So these banknotes could be used for all kinds of things except to pay taxes.
Yeah, the crown used them to pay for expenses, and they circulated, and people used them.
And people used them as money.
And the bank was also giving loans to private individuals with their banknotes. So they were out there circulating. And we'll see later how they made it even more easy to do, the bank. Was that you, Will?
No.
You just read, okay. So, Martin, do the next two.
Okay. Source of profit to the bank. The first prospect of a dividend, then, which the shareholders was the 8%, which the government stipulated to pay on the loan with £4,000 a year for management. The other sources were the circulation of their own bills, which they issued on the loan which they had made, and on which they agreed to pay interest, and the profits which they might make from the capital which their customers deposited with them. They invested these deposits... They invited these deposits by the offer of 4% interest.
Right, so they were taking deposits too. From people, and investing them, you know. Do the next one.
To recharge 4% for their own stuff.
But they gave their deposit 4%.
The Chancellor of the Exchequer, fearful of failure, the Chancellor of the Exchequer was Montague, wasn't it, or was it?
Yeah. At a certain point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Montague was later, though, wasn't it? So this isn't Montague,
Actually, I think it was 1694, the same year that the bank was chartered. Mm-hmm. He became Chancellor of the Exchequer. Yeah.
Okay.
So he might not have been at this point. At the point they're passing this law.
Right. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, fearful of failure, provided for a further $300,000 to be raised in the form of annuities, which is why the Act refers to £1,500,000. He need not have worried. The subscription for the bank taken at the Mercer's Chapel filled in 12 days. It had opened on June the 21st, 1694. The Queen applying for £10,000.
That was the most any one individual could get of the subscription. £10,000.
Wow. Day one, Thursday, June 21st. £600,000 subscribed. By Tuesday, June the 26th, £900,000 subscribed. By noon, Monday, July 2nd, £1,200,000 subscribed, which is the sum total. And over there we have Mercer's Hall.
So there must have been a lot of people going in and out of that hall for that week. because everything was taken.
60, 90, 120 different individuals.
But even more, because only 11 to 20 of them actually had $10,000.
Yeah.
And the other ones had less.
Probably about 300 or 400 people.
Yeah, yeah.
They must have had a lot of faith in this proposal.
Exactly. Why?
Yeah.
I wonder what was being really told to them. Quite
even, even the offer of 4%, you would still wonder, well, am I going to get my money?
No, it was 8%.
The bankers.
On the prior slide, that it said they attracted the subscribers by offering 4%.
No? Not the subscribers, the depositors to the bank.
Oh.
If you wanted to deposit money in their bank, they would give you 4% of your money, and then they'd lend your money out and invest it.
Oh.
Yeah, the 8% is pretty high from the other proposals.
Yeah.
Yeah. That probably attracted them, you're right. The 8%. What is that?
I would take it.
Don, why don't you do the next one?
Because I can't see. Patterson's proposal, Montague's Bank. Out of 1,267 individual original shareholders of the Bank of England. Wow.
So that's how many went in and out of that versus Hall.
There were only 11 contributions.
Contributors.
Contributors of the permitted maximum amount of £10,000.
And these are the 11?
11 were the King and Queen, the Earl of Portland, Mr. William Bentinck, six individuals described only as esquires, which are horsemen.
Is that true? Is that what that means?
Yeah, they take care of the horses.
Oh, okay.
James de Bretonnière of London, sounds like a Frenchman, William Brownlow of Woodcock, Surrey, Thomas Howard, Thomas Malso of the Middle Temple, a barrister, Anthony Humberstone in London, and Anthony Parsons in London. The remaining four subscribers of the maximum amount allowed were elected members of the first court of directors. Sir John Houblon, son of London merchant, 1689 London sheriff, London alderman, 1689 to 1712, member of a grocer's guild, mayor, 1695. Director, East India Company, from 1700 to 1701. 20 members of his family were also early stockholders. Brother Abraham Houblon, Theodore Jansen, financier and member of Parliament, ruined as director of the South Sea Company. Sir William Scawen, a British member of Parliament, some years in business, also governor of East India Company, from 1710 to 1712. And some of them are in the photo, the drawing, I should say, signing the charter of the bank.
Right. Houblon and his brother, Jansen, Scawen. well, so Houblon was, I shouldn't say that. Houblon, these guys were directors, so they'd be signing.
Mm-hmm.
Those last four.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I put the details of this because, you know, to see just who were the big spenders here. And of course there were six that we don't know who they were. They just were esquires. We don't know, you know.
But well, isn't an answer to the question of why did they do this that they could tax the people of England to be paid?
Well, yeah, it was, figured the government would always be there to collect the taxes, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is right where the people started paying taxes.
But you know, I think it's even, well, no, there's a lot of tax before this.
To the bankers.
Right. But even what you said is totally, totally true. But on top of that, remember, the power was in the commons, right? So not only in terms of that the taxes would be used, but that the government itself was going to enforce it.
Yeah.
You know. They didn't have to depend on the crown, the monarch.
These guys were going to get paid.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's a win-win situation.
And I think you're next, right? He's one of the original subscribers of the 10,000 pounds.
It's a magnificent portrait. Look at the sash around his hips.
It's true.
Ribbons.
And again, a big wig.
Yeah.
Okay. The Earl of Portland, William Bentinck, a Dutch and English, he's both Dutch and English,
yeah,
nobleman, who became in an early stage the favorite of William, Prince of Orange, Stadtholder in the Netherlands and future King of England. Bentinck superintended the arrangements for the invasion, including raising money, hiring an enormous transport fleet, organizing a propaganda offensive, and preparing the possible landing sites, and also sailed to England with Prince William. He had also been, since 1687, a medium of communication between his master and his English friends.
Huh. So this is a Dutchman who came over?
Mm-hmm.
So
two passports.
Two passports, yeah. So when you know what we've been learning about the Dutch transferring themselves,
yeah,
and their monarch over to England, and their financial expertise, yeah,
very sneaky,
yes,
you know, a little bitty outfit, and they did all that,
yeah. Well, they had the Jekyll Island here in the United States. There's like 10 bankers out on that island doing their little thing. Okay, next is Fran.
Yep. So, more contributors to the bank. The King and Queen of England. Marlborough invested large sums in the East India Company in 1697, became governor of the Hudson Bay Company. Lord Shrewsbury, Godolphin, whatever that is, invested £7,000, predicted that the Bank of England would not only finance trade, but would carry the burden of her wars. Duke of Devonshire, William Cavendish, also had signed the invitation to William to assume the throne of England. Duke of Leeds, Sir Thomas Osborne, who also signed the invitation to William. Earl of Pembroke, Thomas Herbert, who became the first Lord of the Admiralty and later Lord Privy Seal. Earl of Carnarvon, the Lord Edward Russell, joined the service of William in 1683, was appointed Treasurer of the Navy in 1689, First Lord of Admiralty 1696 to 1717, and Lord Justice.
Stop right there. Just notice Lord Edward Russell, he was working for William even before William came over to England.
Yeah.
You see how that works?
Okay.
Yeah.
Five years.
Yeah.
Cool. And Lord Justice, 1697-1714. Dr. Hugh Chamberlain, John Askill, an eccentric writer and pamphleteer. Dr. Nicholas Barbon, son of Praise God Barebones, who started the first insurance company in Great Britain.
Praise God Barebones?
That's a bit of a weird name. John Holland, a reputed Englishman who also started the Bank of Scotland in 1695. Salmon de Medina, wealthy Holland Jew who went with William to England as an army contractor, first Jew to be knighted. Sir Gilbert Heathcote, Director of Bank of England, 1699-1701. 1723-25, he was sheriff and later Lord Mayor of London and founded the New East India Company in 1693. Marquess of Normandy, John Sheffield, who also held the title of Duke of Buckingham, he is buried in Westminster Abbey. And the philosopher John Locke, there's a picture of William Cavendish, the Duke of Devonshire. Interesting.
Yeah, so notice the connections that these people have with already existing financial institutions, for one, with the government, with William, even before he came over. You know, I thought this is really, you know, get down to the details of who these people were, you know. Two of them had signed, two of these on this page had signed the letter inviting William over. You know, so I guess they were getting paid, their payment here, you know.
Sounds like an inside job.
Yeah. Or Dutch outside job or something.
Yeah.
So Will, why don't you do the next one? You don't have to read that. I just put that as an example.
Okay. These are the subscriptions of £500 made by Sir Ralph Radcliffe, 1633-1720, for his wife. The first is dated June 1694, when the government were raising funds to create the bank, and the second is dated September 1694, just after the bank had been formed for the second payment of £125.
Yeah, these were being auctioned off at some art house. Quite a big amount of money.
Well, that's how they raise it, with auction.
Auction today. These were being auctioned
today. Today is common for historical purposes.
Yeah, for historical papers. I guess, you know, that's an interesting question. Back then in June of 1694, was there a long queue waiting to get in there? Or what? First come, first serve? Or, oh, my lord, you come in before so-and-so. You don't know.
Rank, yeah.
You don't know.
Was it raining?
We'll do the next one.
Okay. Christopher Hollis, The Two Nations, in his book, The Two Nations, page 33, he got a picture of a Bank of England note. Now, if a corporation lends money at interest and without risk, then relends the repaid loan, and so on, never distributing more than a trifle of its profits, either as wages or dividends, then, however small its original capital, however moderate its rate of interest, it is but a simple proposition in mathematics that in the course of time it must necessarily become the
possessor
of the entire wealth of the country. Compound interest.
Yeah, on a principle that never gets paid.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And gets bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, grows and grows.
Yes, grows and grows. Yeah. Martin, do the next one. The Bank of England, I like this part, founded in stealth.
That's not the name of a little town.
No.
No, it sounds Dutch, doesn't it?
That's stealth.
Okay, Bank of England founded in stealth. An interesting technique is revealed by the charter of the Bank of England. It was slipped through as part of the tonnage bill, which was later to become recognized parliamentary technique.
Yes.
On both sides of the Atlantic.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. The charter provides that rates and duties upon tonnage of ships are made security to such persons as shall voluntarily advance the sum of £1,500,000 towards carrying on the war against France. And over there we have the Great Hall, the Bank of England.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what's right inside that front door. That's the front door.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, they had the old building, then they had the fire, and then they had a newer building.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not sure. This is one of the older ones, I think.
Yeah, that'd be the older one. But they designed it the same. Yeah. Except this one's glass. The one they have now is cast iron.
Yeah.
What is it you're talking about this year?
Martin, do the next one, too.
Okay. From the writings of William Paterson. All this while, the very name of a bank or corporation was avoided, though the notion of both was intended. The proposers thinking it prudent that a design of this nature should have as easy and insensible a beginning as possible, to prevent or at least gradually to soften and remove the prejudices and bad impressions commonly conceived in the minds of men against things of this kind before they are understood.
Wow.
That is an awful thing to say.
Wow, very...
There's a lot of words to say. We have to hide this from the public.
Yeah, exactly what was copied. You served as a template for the Jekyll Island group.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We'll call it the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
No one will know.
Don, do the next one.
Bank of England founded in stealth. The promoters of the bank argued that the bank would be founded upon a reserve that cannot fail. But with the nation, it was using government debt as collateral. But what they did not point out was that although the bank would be paid interest on this created loan, the bank was completely unnecessary in this money creation process. The government could have created its own paper notes based on the same security and not paid any interest on it to anyone. And unlike the Bank of Amsterdam, which was owned by the government, the Bank of England was owned and controlled by private individuals.
And that's Stephen Zarlinga's words.
This is good. Yeah.
Yeah. This is what he wanted to point out.
Very clear writer.
Do the next one. Done.
The first 9 years of the Bank of England, the security to the shareholders was the good faith of government. And only 2 years had elapsed since the government had begun the public debt with the annuities. The lottery loan of $1 million was an operation undertaken simultaneously with that of the Bank of England and had been a rapid success. But it was to be extinguished in 16 years.
The principal.
The loan of the bank was the first permanent loan, for though provision was made that the privilege of the bank should cease in 1706 if its capital were repaid in 1705, no man of sense imagined that any government would ever extinguish so useful a corporation. Quoted from Thorhall Rogers, the first 9 years of the Bank of England.
Yep. So these financiers knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Ann, you want to go?
You can't dislodge them.
Credit-based economy. Why is government credit under a private bank different from private government credit with public money? The bank's great strength was that in response to the previously existing fear of royal default and the crown's obligations, it served as a commitment device, making the government's promise to pay its debts trustworthy.
And this is something, you know, to think about. I mean, today, the government, you can't trust the government. Back then, they did have, the crown had defaulted. They had to stop on the exchequer, mm-hmm. and they stopped redeeming their debt. And there was the one where Charles II took the money that was in the tower, and the goldsmiths went bankrupt because they couldn't get to their money,
yeah.
you know. But today, it's the propaganda, anti-government propaganda. It's not, this is what I always say to people, it's not like, well, let's clean up our government so we can have our government. You know, it's like, no, you can't trust government, forget that. So what do you have? You have Enron,
mm-hmm.
you know. Do the next one too.
The bank blackmailed the crown. From the 1.2 billion pound, million pounds subscribed, the bank gave the government 720 pounds cash, 480 pound banknotes. The bank retained 480 pounds cash.
It's actually millions.
Oh, millions. Oh, okay.
Thousands, 100,000, 480.
Okay, 480, 100,000 pounds cash, 720,000 pound banknotes. The government spent the notes into circulation for war. The bank spent the notes into circulation to buy up William's tally stick IOUs at 7% discount. The bank's notes became a part of the money supply. If William wished to change this, he would either have to repudiate the debt, which might bring James II back, or repay the loan, which needed the Parliament to vote extra taxation, but Parliament was under the influence of the bank.
He was stuck. This man was stuck.
Yeah.
They knew what they were doing. Boy, I tell you. Very cunning. When I first read this, that I just assumed I'm an innocent, you know, here, that they would give, well, 1.2 million of gold and silver to the government.
And they kept.
No. They, you know, they're tricks. They're tricks. You know?
Give banknotes instead.
Yeah, so that, and then he had to use them. He had to pay for his war. So he had to use them. Mm-hmm. And then they became circulating and accepted. You know? Oof, I tell you, these cunning.
Can we go to that slide? I'm trying to understand the 1,200,000 there.
Make those 720 and 480 into hundreds of thousands.
And add them up. 20 and 80 are 100, and 7, 4, 11, 12 comes up to 1,200,000 pounds.
Okay. So basically the bank... So the 1,200,000 actually was actually cash. So it gave 720,000 of that cash to the government and retained 480,000 of that cash for themselves.
Right.
And then created this additional money there, the banknotes. And they gave 480,000 to the government and retained the 720,000 banknotes.
Right.
So basically, they took in 1,200,000 pounds from subscribers, but actually then on additionally to that created another 1,200,000 in banknotes.
Right, which they were entitled to according to the Act.
Right.
But instead of giving all the cash to William for the war, they said, no. We'll also give him our banknotes because he'll have to use them, and then people will accept them. Mm-hmm. Very cunning.
And then their own issue, a use of banknotes would be more acceptable to the population.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And they used their banknotes to buy up his other debt at a discount.
Yeah. Is that 7% out of 100?
Yeah.
1/14 of the value of the debt?
No, that's discount off the par value.
It's 93%.
Yeah, 93%. Oh. But it's like, I read this and I think of it and I feel like it's like a cobra.
Mm-hmm. Strangled.
Strangling, you know. It's just from every part, it's just strangling.
Pythons are the ones that strangle.
What, Will?
Pythons are the ones that strangle.
Yeah.
The cobras bite you.
Yeah, python is a good image.
Yeah. Mangrove swamps with the python romps.
And not just in one area, but in many areas. You know, it's like that they're coming at it from many areas at the same time. Yeah. Okay, I think Fran, you're next.
Cool. We're on From Its Inception? Or on Part 7?
Yes.
From Its Inception. The bank lent freely. Prices rose from 100 to 137 between June 1694 and August 1695. It is then obvious why that the bank inflated in 1695. The incidental consequence of inflation was a rise of prices. Its essential consequence was so to increase the proportion of banks' money in circulation to king's money as to make the bank's money an essential part of the nation's economy. From Christopher Hollis, The Two Nations. The government, quite mistaking the disease, thought that the rise in prices was due to the clip money, although English money had been clipped since the beginning of time, and prices had remained perfectly stable since Cromwell's death.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's
dear.
That's what they do today, right? That's what they do today.
So basically, the government had not understood that the Bank of England was creating money.
Probably not.
You're like our politicians today. They don't know the money system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Opposition to the bank. Will, why don't you do this one?
Patterson points out enemies of the bank. I guess the Jacobists, the Goldsmiths.
Jacobites.
Goldsmiths and mistrusting landholders. Enemies of the bank are threefold. The Jacobites, who know what its effect will be on their patron, Louis of France. Two, some few users and brokers of money. Three, those who have not wherewith to trade, unless it be like Haman of old, for whole nations are a people at once. By the last two classes, the writer appears to mean the goldsmiths and Chamberlain and his associates.
Chamberlain was the landowner who had the, and he was also a physician, had the idea for the land bank. So the landowners who wanted land banks.
Okay.
Explain to me, but Haman was the bad guy that Queen Esther ratted on and they got him killed so he wouldn't have the Jews killed or something like that, right?
I don't know who that is.
Haman was, Esther realized that he was, I don't remember the plot, but he was out to have the Jews killed for some reason, some personal gain, and she risked her life to go to the king without being called, because she was just a concubine, and told him about the plot, and then he took care of Haman, and the Jews survived.
Who took care of Haman?
The king. He got rid of him.
Oh.
You know how the mafia say, I'll take care of him, and that means I've been killed.
Yeah, I didn't know. Yeah. I didn't know that reference in the Bible. So those were some of the people protesting. We'll do this one too.
Some opposed it on economic and moral grounds. Who can think that posterity will be willing to pay a tax of 110,000 pounds per annum on the original loan, not for the support of their own government for the time being, but to go into the pockets of private men, strangers as well as natives? And you got a picture of William Lowndes.
Right, he was an economist back then.
Oh, he said that?
He said that, yeah. But he was saying the right thing, right?
He predicted
yeah.
Profit.
Yeah.
Profit bill.
Profit of private men. And for posterity.
No, I meant a prophet, P-R-O-P-H-E-T.
Yeah. Oh, prophet. Oh, right. Yeah, but it's...
He predicts the future.
Martin.
Okay. Tories formed competing land bank April 1696. Dr. Hugh Chamberlain's proposal to make England rich and happy. Who can argue with that? The bank was to advance money on the security of landed property by issuing large quantities of notes. Land was the reserve asset. The fallacy with a land bank, as new money is created on land security, the value of property is inflated. So even more money is created. Eventually this bubble bursts. Within 5 months of its creation, only a few thousand pounds were subscribed. The landowners had tried to establish the bank in the middle of a general recoinage when coin was scarce.
They weren't financiers.
They were farmers.
The historical case was an important indicator of the eventual dominance of the landed interest by the money power. The landowners wanted the land bank to get money, not to invest money in land. While they were land rich, they were cash poor and generally wanted to borrow money. The bank soon created a new class of moneyed interests in the city, as opposed to the power of the old barons whose fortunes derive from their landholding.
Yeah, and we're going to see, as the English history goes on, in the first half of the 18th century, how these landholders lose their land because of the money system. Yeah. Don?
That's easy. First day of Bank of England. The condition of the first failure. The condition of the English currency had become scandalous. It seems that much of it was clipped to less than a third of its proper weight. If I can rely on an exceedingly rare and valuable work in the Bodleian Library, the study of which is essential for the interpretation of the foreign exchanges during the period of which I am writing, there were still in circulation in England coins dating from the days of the Plantagenet kings, and when in proper condition, these were taken at their modern value. Even some of the base money of Henry VIII and Edward VI had escaped Elizabeth's melting pot and was duly appointed by the dealers in currency.
That's good. Yeah.
Coins clipped less than a third of its weight. Thorold Rogers, the first 9 years of the Bank of England.
Okay. Do this one too.
The government undertook a recoinage, reducing the money supply. In concert with John Lord Somers, Matthew Locke, and Sir Isaac Newton, Montague devised the mill coinage that made this abuse impossible, and paid for this reissue of the coinage by the invention of the window tax.
This man is getting into everything. Now, I'm just having the thought. He knows how the bank works. He's very astute with financial things. So he must have known, I can't imagine he didn't know, that the bank was causing this inflation. But then he goes along with recoining the coinage at the same time, blaming it on the coinage, the rise in prices, right?
Mm.
So all the stuff that was going on here.
But that's the opposite of what happened by creating a shortage, is the opposite of a rise in prices. Prices can't go up unless there's more money available.
Right, the bank was making more notes available.
Notes instead, I see.
Yeah, causing the rise in prices.
And the coins were the valuable things. Were getting to be cheaper, or no, they were getting to be more expensive because he was restricting them.
Well, the coins were clipped.
Yeah.
The silver coins.
William III's silver sixpence minted in 1696. This is one of the earliest milled edge coins. It remained in circulation throughout much of the 18th century.
Okay.
So they could, they were unclippable.
They were pretty smooth to me.
Right, the milled edges.
I don't see any little lines on them.
Yeah.
Of course, the lines are perpendicular to my eyesight.
Yeah, I can see. Look,
yeah, right there. That's right.
See that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So they couldn't be clipped.
Huh.
Yeah. And do the next one.
They cut the other one down.
First failure of the Bank of England. Affected by the recoinage, the bank failed for the first time in 1696. It could no longer redeem its paper notes in coinage. Oh! William Paterson pointed out the manipulation of the money power by the bank for benefit of its own members, not society.
This is a quote from Paterson.
Paterson. Would they be indulged at the price of the nation's suffering? I am sure they deserve no indulgence at all. It is not impossible that they may return to their senses and act as becomes men. Therefore, as we usually did bid beggars work, so must I bid these men pay. They are opulent and can do it. They ought, upon the first sense of distress, to have called in the 40% from each of their members instead of calling for it. They have borrowed 20% of their members as a favor. Does this remind you of the too big to fail banks in the crisis of 2008?
They don't want to lose anything. They don't want to lose anything. Yeah. Gradual development of the bank. This is the last part. Anne, why don't you do this one?
Okay. The bank fit the government's need for war finance. The national debt increased steadily during the 18th century, from 12 million pounds in 1700 to 850 million pounds by the end of the Napoleonic Wars. So, we see here in this chart, this was a 700% rise in the national debt between 1700 and 1815.
So just crept up.
From 12 to 850 million.
Debt in million. This is slow, incremental, one war after another, need more money.
It's not a straight line. Oh, that's a curved line. It's increasing rapidly.
That looks exponential.
Every year gets much bigger. And you remember what happened after the Battle of Waterloo? It was Rothschild, I forget his first name, who pretended that England had lost the war, so everybody would sell their bonds that they had borrowed.
They ran out and bought them.
Nathan Rothschild.
Yeah.
And he then cleaned them all up by having his other men buy the what they were selling cheap.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Creating a huge fortune to set them on the...
Wow.
Where they still retain their earnings.
Wow. Oh, boy. Hello? Hold on a second.
Harry Potter. 5618. That's an economist.
Great.
That's what he's contributing
the last time. Okay, sorry about that interruption. I had to do that. Okay. Who's next there? Is that Fran?
Sure. We on the bank accumulated power slowly.
Yes. No. Accumulated power over the people.
Slide 50.
Bank accumulated power of the people. The bank's main protection, its complexity, kept people from understanding the true source of its power, the money creation process. Excellent. Cartoon, just what is it the College of Economics has contributed in the past 100 years? Absolutely. It's quite amazing that this Bank of England article actually says like economics textbooks are wrong in their description of the money creation process.
Oh.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading that.
Yeah.
I want to send that out to quite a few people.
Definitely.
So I guess,
shall I read the next one?
I guess all those economics textbook writers are running off to get their next edition.
Yeah. Let's hope so. They're going to write, yes, to match something actually useful.
You do the next two, Fran.
Okay, so the bank accumulated power slowly. Nice picture of a snail. For many years, its notes circulated only in London. In 1698, a clause enacted permitting the Treasury to accept the bank's notes for taxes. Then in 1709, the charter was renewed with the right to double capital and note issuance. And then in 1844, it got the monopoly on the banknote issuance.
And I'm sure we'll learn other things between 1700 and 1850, that gradually they got one privilege increased with another, and, you know, that's how they did it.
Yeah.
Samuel got his nose in the tent.
Yes, exactly. Oh, God. What an image, right? And then it's left fore leg goes in. Do the next one, Frank.
Okay, the bank's slow growth in privileges indicates its power was kept within a small circle. So this is by J. Keith Horsfield, British Monetary Experiments, 1650 to 1710. So he wrote that in 1960. A favourite accusation was that the bank had fallen into the hands of a close ring of related families which put their interests above those of the commercial world generally. Mm. You've got a wealth pyramid there which shows what's that showing?
The percentage at the top.
Yeah, the 1%. So the wealth range of the total wealth percentage of the world.
Yeah, that's just a general thing. You know, it's like even there's like talk about the 0.1% of the 1%.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they kept Horsfield is basically, you know, saying, hypothesizing that the power was kept very, very concentrated, you know. And that's it.
Mm-hmm. Great.